This is the Tan Talk Radio Network.
Patsy with a Z. Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing, and for everyone who wants to know the story behind the book. And I am known as the last of the red hot book lovers because I just love books, and it's really exciting that I get to talk to so many authors, not just, you know, best-selling authors, but authors who have just come out with books or authors who have just finished NaNoWriMo. And I'm so excited that nine of my listeners finished NaNoWriMo this year. But today's a very special day. It is the 82nd anniversary of Pearl Harbor. And for me, it's such a significant day and such an important day. I've had the thrill over these 9 years that I've been doing Joy on Paper to be able to talk to military heroes and to talk about their books and help promote their books. And my goal here at Joy on Paper has always been not to forget an important book. You know, when books come out, really, it's very difficult for authors nowadays. A book comes out and, well, they have a few weeks, maybe a few months to promote their books, and then nobody ever asks them about their books again. But I want to keep reminding my listeners and everyone about books that they should read. So I'm going to be talking about two authors today, and one I'm going to play a repeat of an interview I had with him back in 2016, and that's Johnny Clark. And I love his book, Gunner's Glory, The Untold Story of a Marine Machine Gunners. And this is a wonderful book, ideal for reading today. And I will be talking more about that and about his other books because he is a real American hero. And that will be at the bottom of the hour. But right now, my dad was also an American hero. He was awarded the Silver Star. You know, he was the most wonderful father anyone could ever have. He was just a fantastic person, very humble. He never really talked about his war experiences. And it wasn't until I think I was about 11 years old when we had a visitor come to the house. And he wanted to come and he wanted to meet again. No Danger L. And we didn't know what he was talking about. We didn't understand what he was saying because we knew that my father would always say no danger to us. Like if we had to do something, if we wanted something, he'd say no danger. And we didn't know why he would say that. It was just a funny experience. We thought we couldn't figure it out. And it wasn't until somebody came to the house and said, I have to see, I'm in town. I want to see No Danger L. And it was so amazing. He explained that he was one of the people who had met my dad. And my dad was, when he went into the European, when I think about it, I think about what he did from D-Day on, walking across Europe. And when he was always with his men, he was the old man of his patrol. Most of them were 18, some were 17 because they had lied to get into and join the army. And so he was the old man of the team. He was in his 20s. And he would always walk in front of the rest of the patrol when they were walking down a road. And he would walk in front, and then he would turn around, and he'd say, no danger. That means he had stepped on a landmine, for goodness sakes. And but he had a sure instinct for some reason, thank God. He just kept walking. And when you think about it, from the time that they landed in Normandy and the long time it took to get eventually to the Battle of the Bulge area, they're thinking how many miles he walked and how many men followed in his footsteps. And so he was called No Danger L. And so I want to play first the song for all the army guys, just to, and gals nowadays, to just honor them. So we'll play the song and then I'll come back and I want to tell you a little story about what happened to my father on December 7th. The army one. Okay, are you ready? I can't. Okay, Ed's just pulling it up. You know, it's so funny when you think about World War II and that we are now in another war. We're in another war in Europe that we never, ever thought would be, we'd ever have another war in Europe. And when we think about it, it's just so, so strange. So we're going to play The Army Goes Rolling Along. Ed, do you have that for my dad? That song, and I love to think of my dad and what he was doing on December 7th, 1941. He would always talk about the day, of course, you know, when Pearl Harbor happened, it was such a shock. He was, we had a, have a farm in northern Michigan, and he was in the attic bedroom that he shared with three of his brothers, and they had four beds lined up along the attic. It was the really the attic, so the wall, the ceiling was slanted, and he was in bed. It was in the afternoon, about 1 o'clock, because they were he'd already done his chores and he was reading before Sunday dinner. And when someone started yelling, you know, to come downstairs, and he bumped his head, as he jumped up, forgot that the ceiling was slanted. And so, of course, everyone gathered around the radio and listened about what was happening, and the news from Hawaii. So that was a Sunday afternoon. And on Monday morning, he jumped up ready to get into town to volunteer. And he got out of the house, and he slipped. There was, of course, December in northern Michigan. You've got snow, you've got ice. And along the way, as he was heading to get to town, he slipped and fell and broke his leg. Oh, he was devastated. It just made him crazy, because he wanted to, you know, join in on that Monday. But so he had a broken leg, but he healed. It was one of, you know, not, it was a break, but he healed soon. And he was then in the Army. And he went, of course, to the European Theater. He was sent there, and he served under someone that, you know, I've heard about him all of my life, because my father would talk about General Omar Bradley. He was serving under Omar Bradley, and Omar Bradley, for those of you who don't know, he was known as the GI's general. The men loved him. He was approachable. He was, my father would say that he was just so nice to everybody, and everybody felt comfortable around him. And my father was thrilled when he had the opportunity to meet him and you know, be around him. So I had heard about Omar Bradley all of my life. And as I grew up, I read, of course, a lot of books about World War II. And I was so thrilled when I was able to have on my program an author who wrote, I think, the best book about Omar Bradley. It's called Omar Bradley, General at War, The Generals. And it's by Jim DeFelice. It is a wonderful book. It is an in-depth biography. And for those of you who don't know, Omar Bradley was a 5-star general, not just 4-star, a 5-star general, and actually the last of the 5-star generals. And this book is so beautifully researched and so well written that it's like reading a novel, because it just flows so beautifully. But it is a wonderful book, and I hope that, you know, we are all looking now nowadays between having a war in Europe, a war in the Middle East. You wonder what is going on. And sometimes you have to say, have we learned from history? Have we learned the lessons that we were supposed to learn? And in many cases, I think not. So why should you read this book? You know, Omar Bradley is an example of another great American hero. He was just so clever and so smart, but he never, ever sort of pushed himself ahead. He was self-effacing, is a good way, I suppose, to explain him. He was humble. He was just an American who wanted to do his job and the best he could do for America. And why I like Jim DeFelice's book is that he goes into the story of how Omar Bradley came to be such a leader, because everybody, of course, has heard of Patton, and they've done the movie with Patton, and you have this sort of image of a general. But when you have somebody like Omar Bradley, who just, he was a man who tried to work things out, thought about things, and this book, I think you will really enjoy. So it is called Omar Bradley, General at War. It's available on Amazon. It is now, really, I think, a classic among military books of World War II, because it's something that you must read. In many cases, you know, the things that we remember about the war, we know about Patton, of course, and about General Eisenhower and what he did. But behind the scenes, one who did not take all the credit and did not try to take all the credit is Omar Bradley. And so I hope that you will think about getting this book and then think about, sort of put it in perspective. And there were mistakes made, and he admits that there were mistakes made. And the nice thing about this book is it's very well balanced. So if you look at what were the mistakes of that war, and what are the mistakes we're making today, and what do we require from our military, and how we can get to that point where we don't make those same mistakes. So I think Omar Bradley, General at War, is a book that you should read. It's a great book. And I just, you know, for me, because my dad, knowing that my dad was very humble all of his life, he never told us war stories. He didn't talk about it. He never took any credit. He never, you know, and he was very humble when people would talk about, you know, what he did, or because, as I said, when we had this guest arrive and say, I just need to, you know, meet and shake hands again with No Danger L. My father was very humble, and he never wanted to say, you know, that he grabbed a hand grenade that was thrown into a bunker where his men were stationed, and he jumped up. My dad had very long legs. My dad was tall and was a great runner, and he picked up a hand grenade, for goodness sakes, and he ran with it, and just like in the movie, he ran and threw it. And you know, so you look at that and you say, wow, this is so exciting to you know about this kind of thing. And one of the things I wanted to say to all of you, you know, this was 82 years ago. We were attacked at Pearl Harbor. Now, very few people are alive who saw it or who remember it. But you all, so many of you have relatives who were alive during World War II. Have you put together a series of documents, or published a book about what they did? Because all of these memories should be shared and should be preserved. So if you have an idea for a book, send me a message, write me an email. It's patsy.radio@gmail.com, and I will give you some advice on how you can start collecting the documents in your own family and writing your own book and making sure that you save and preserve all of this information, because nowadays it's really easy for you to put together a book, and I can explain it to you, how you can take the documents, scan them, and include them in, so you have the actual record of whoever was in your family who was in the military. So I would, you know, after I worked with the listeners who joined the National Novel Writing Month, I was impressed that several of them did base their stories on family members who had done something, and they wanted to preserve that story. And you can do the same. So please, if you have any like that, just start gathering them up and send me an email. I'm happy to advise anybody about how they can put this together and write a book, because I think these memories are valuable and that they should be preserved. So, because it's something like this, you know, when Jim DeFelice started writing Omar Bradley, he had to do research. I mean, he had to read every, I think this guy must have read, you know, maybe 150 books to write one book. That's the fun of writing. You read so much a nonfiction book because you have to do the research. And it helps if people have actually written and preserved documents. So you might be part of one day of somebody's book about something, and because you preserved memories and you wrote about them. So I hope that we can do that. And actually, I'd love to get together a group of authors who want to work together to come out with a book about particularly about World War II veterans, because as I said, they didn't talk a lot, they didn't brag a lot, but they are wonderful stories to tell about them. So that is a book that I hope that you'll get. Now, meanwhile, also coming up in January, I'm going to be having a guest on Joy on Paper, Johnny Clark. And Johnny Clark has been on the program a number of times over the years since I started Joy on Paper back in 2015. I can't believe it. In March, it will be another anniversary, and I'm excited about that. But one of the things that I was so thrilled when I was, you know, I just started the program, and I was finally meeting local authors and getting together with them. And one of the authors that I met was Johnny Clark. And wow, I was so impressed with him because, well, you know, as I said, I love military books, and I've read so many. I have just on Napoleon alone, I have probably 200 books. So as you see, and Wellington, I have perhaps 40 books about Wellington. So I love to go back in history. I love to read history, and I particularly love to read military history. So when I met Johnny Clark, I invited him to come to Joy on Paper, and so he did. And I want to play this interview that I had with him. It's so cute. You know, I just want to say, I mentioned it in the interview, and this is an interview from 2016. I mentioned it in the interview when I talked about humble. Johnny Clark is humble. He is so sweet. I was, you know, when you talk to a Marine, and I love Marines because twice in my life, they saved my life. One time particularly where a Marine actually sort of broke ranks and came out and rescued me as I was running to the American Embassy. And that's one of the most beautiful sights in the world. If you've ever been in trouble in a foreign country and you run to an American embassy and you see an American Marine standing guard, I tell you, nothing makes you happier. Even now when I think about it, and this is over 30 years ago, and I was really caught up in a insurrection, a riot, or whatever you want to call it. And I had it as I had, luckily I took my father's advice when I was traveling. He said, always, if you're in trouble, head for the American Embassy. And I did. And there was a Marine standing there guard. And so I was really excited about that. And I want to play this interview about the books that Johnny Clark has written. And Johnny Clark is going to be back on Joy on Paper in January, and we will talk about what he's been up to since the last time we spoke. But let's now go straight to the interview with Johnny Clark. This is Patsy with a Z, and I'm back with a real American hero. And I could listen to that song every day because there is nothing like a Marine. Hi, my guest is Johnny M. Clark, a real American hero. Hi, Johnny.
Hi.
Well, don't look so shy about it. Johnny was awarded the Silver Star and 3 Purple Hearts and a few other battle medals in there, right?
Yeah, a couple more.
Oh, it's so cute. Marines get so shy. It doesn't matter how many years they've been out of the Marines, they still get shy when you talk about them. I love it. You know, all you have to do is say Marine Barracks, Hawaii, to be reminded of what the Marines do and what the importance of the Marines in our life. Of course, it's wonderful to have Johnny here today, the day before the 75th anniversary of Pearl Harbor. And anybody who has read history, knows history, has family who was involved, knows how important the Marine, of course, the Marine barracks were sort of center to the events that happened all those years ago. So I'm just so happy to have you on the program today talk about your books and about, you know, all of your service. Of course, you were in the famed 5th Marine Regiment in Vietnam.
Yes.
What was your role there?
I was a machine gunner.
A machine gunner. And you joined the Marines at 17?
Correct. Yeah.
You didn't wait to be drafted?
No.
You just said, I'm going to go.
Yes.
To the Marines. Okay. So that's a nice, brave decision right there, you know, when a 17-year-old says, I'm going to be a Marine. Wow. What was the life expectancy of a Marine gunner?
Well, they told us in machine gun school that the life expectancy was about 7.5 seconds after a firefight began. And, of course, none of us believed it. You know, we thought there wouldn't be any gunners left. And but when we got there, we found out pretty quick that was accurate. Once a firefight began, the war was fought mostly at night, so the only visible target you had was the machine gun because of the tracer rounds. Every 5th round's a tracer round, and so it acts as a big golden arrow pointing right at you. And while I was here, we had no machine gunners in the 5th Marine Regiment rotate home. They spend 13 months and go home. They were all killed or wounded.
Even today, when you think about Vietnam, and we know all of the horrendous things that went on during those years, it's in many ways it's a miracle that you're here.
Yeah, it is. It is.
3 Purple Hearts. That's a lot.
Yeah, I had buddies who had more. My gunnery sergeant had 7, and I had a corporal. An Indian corporal named Swift Eagle, and it was his real name, and he had 7. And so there were a couple of guys with more.
So you took all of your experience, of course, in Vietnam, and you've now written, I think, 8 books?
Yes.
And it's
you know, very it's fascinating, the stories that you've written, and I was really impressed. I just finished No Better Way to Die, and there was a book previous to that, right?
The Old Corps.
The Old Corps. And your main character is just beautifully developed, Jesse Slate. I love this character.
Thanks. I loved him, too. He's based on, you know, real guys. All of them are based on real guys. And a lot of Jesse Slate was based on my old gunnery sergeant and based on a Marine named Francis Hugh Killeen, who was just a remarkable old Marine from World War II in Korea.
And now in this book, No Better Way to Die, I want to say, you know, I always like to read the prologue because it does say a lot about the author. And that is one of the, it's a short prologue, but it's a brilliant prologue. It's really, really well written. And it sets the stage for the entire story. And I was just so impressed with it. Well, I'm impressed with your writing. You know, when did you start writing? All your life you were writing?
No, not really. I I was least likely to ever write anything. I was a terrible English student at St. Pete High School, and I had injured my back in Vietnam. I had to jump out of a chopper. That pilot had been killed. We were coming in on a hot LZ, and the co-pilot panicked and took off before all the Marines were out, and the machine gun's the last one out. So by the time I hit the ramp, we were about 40 feet up in the air, and so I had to make a long jump with, you know, a flak jacket, helmet, 400 rounds of ammo, a 25-pound machine gun, and pack, canteens, grenades. So I landed like an anchor, and my back was never that great after that. And then I became a mailman, and the back I was delivering books to Haslam's Bookstore, and the back popped. That was kind of the end of it, and it took away two jobs at once. I was about to have an accredited course. I teach martial arts, and it was going to be an accredited course at the University of South Florida, and I was working a mailman during the daytime, and so I lost both jobs with one bad back. So I was down for a while, and I told my wife, you know, I'm going to have to come up with another way to make a living here. And I'd had a lot of friends tell me I needed to write about some of the stuff that happened to me in Nam. And I started taking a writing course out of St. Pete College. And it was a course where they would critique 10 pages a week. It was a creative writing course. You know, it wasn't for credit. And so it went about 8 weeks. So I would have 10 pages of my book critiqued every week. When the course ended, I would just wait for the next course to start. And I ended up taking that course about 15 times. So I got the whole book critiqued by some good writing instructors. And so me being a writer, it's really that whole book, Guns Up, became a bestseller. But it was the book was a miracle. I mean, it was rejected by every publisher in New York, from New York to California. Every publisher that I could find had rejected it. And at one point, my wife and I had started a Bible study, and in this Bible study, we had memory verses. Well, there was one verse, and I'm sure everybody's got a story like this, but there was one verse that just haunted me. And it was, if you honor God, God will honor you. It was 2 Samuel 2:30. And, well, long story short is I had cuss words in Guns Up because I didn't see any other way to tell a nonfiction true story about what we did in Nam without the dialogue and the way we talked. And, you know, the Marine Corps,
yeah.
Pretty rough group of guys. And so I didn't see any other way to write it at the time without the real dialogue, without the way we talked. But I got so convicted about it, and the book had been rejected for 4 years by every publisher on earth. So I told my wife, I've got to sit down, I've got to take all these words out. And I told my professors at the college, and they both said, you're going to ruin the best war book we've ever read. It's going to sound like Howdy Doody Joins the Marine Corps if you take all the cuss words out of it. And I said, I can't help it, I'm going to have to do it. Well, I did. It took 6 months. It was like going to the dentist every day because it's like reliving your war, which is no fun. And but within 7 days of that rewrite being finished, I felt like an anchor had been taken off me. So I started sending the book out again. And within a month, I had 9 book publishers who wanted that book. But within 7 days of finishing that book, I started getting phone calls from Soldier of Fortune magazine, Eagle magazine, American Legion magazine. And they're calling me saying, we've got this story that you sent us. And I said, I don't remember sending you a story. And he said, yeah, we just found it in our slush pile. And I said, when did I send you that? I said, I'd look at the date and I go, oh, he sent it to us 4 years ago. And each publisher, each magazine said the same thing. And I said, so you're just now finding it after 4 years this week. You know, and you know, I'm not the smartest Marine that ever came out of Parris Island, but I know when God slaps me upside the head. And so it was a miracle. The book's a miracle. The Lord blessed it. It became a bestseller. They asked me to write other books. And
I think, of course, that's Guns Up, a firsthand account of the Vietnam War. And I think it's been republished how many times?
I think it's in a 35th printing.
35th printing.
Yeah, it was taught at the War College. It's taught in a lot of colleges and high schools, required reading in a lot of places. And the book's just a miracle. It's almost been a movie 3 times. It hasn't happened, but...
But you never know.
You never know.
You never know. Because there are some new war movies coming out, and I think new appreciation for our military, which is...
Yes.
Fantastic.
I
because
agree.
It is time. I was telling you earlier a story that my father, when I started traveling around the world on my own, the one thing my father said is, if you're ever in trouble, look for a Marine. And one time, this exactly happened. I was in the middle of a little bit of an uprising, and I headed straight for the American Embassy, and there, to see that Marine guard standing there, so beautiful. It's when you're in trouble in a foreign country and you see a Marine, wow, it's something. It's something special. It's like one of the most beautiful visions in the world. So, yeah.
That's great. I mean, I love that story. That's
well,
a great story.
He's blushing because he knows that, just exactly what it feels like to be standing there in that uniform and the... What it gives the people who are in trouble and who need help to know that the Marines are there. And I was talking about, of course, Pearl Harbor. And the Marines at that time, of course, in the Marine barracks, it was the Marines who were raising the flag at the time when the planes came over. Mm-hmm. And they were the first... With the guns, they ran immediately to their stations, and so many of them lost their lives there. And of course, after that, in all of the battles that went on, so it's just, you know, we owe so much to the Marine Corps.
Well, thanks. It's great to hear. It wasn't long after that that. The Guadalcanal happened, and the book I gave you there called Gunner's Glory, there's a couple of men in that who tell their stories. They were machine gunners on Guadalcanal, one with Edson's Raiders and the other with the 7th Marine Regiment. And one is Mitchell Page. He won the Medal of Honor, and he's the guy that Hasbro Toys made the G.I. Joe doll after. And he told me, both those guys, Ted Elliston and Mitchell Page, they're both gone now. But they told me some of the most incredible stories from Guadalcanal. But a lot of people who don't study history don't realize that if a small group of Marines had not held Bloody Ridge or Edson's Ridge, whatever you want to call it, the ridge that surrounded Henderson Field, if they had not held on to that one ridge, the Japanese would have taken... Guadalcanal, they had taken Henderson Field, we'd have lost Guadalcanal, and they would have invaded Australia. And of course, the next step was California, but they would have taken Australia. So I sometimes wonder if the people in Australia understand how close they were. It just one machine gun position was left on Bloody Ridge at one point, and Mitchell Page made it to that machine gun. He outran a Japanese soldier and made it to that machine gun and helped hold Edson's Ridge. it's just remarkable stories these guys had. And, you know, I got his story on his deathbed, you know, and he told me a miracle that happened to him on Guadalcanal. He said he couldn't even tell the other guys because they would have, he was afraid they'd think he had shell shock. But he told me an amazing miracle that happened to him on Guadalcanal, and I'm writing about that now in a new book I'm working on.
Well, that's going to be a fantastic story. Now, one of the things you mentioned, taking out the bad language, and so I read No Better Way to Die, and I noticed, of course, that there's not the really, really, really dirty language, which makes it, one, it's very, I think that men who read it can fill in the blanks, but it makes it also accessible to women who might object to bad language, because this is a wonderful story, the story about Jesse Slate, and about, I love his, all the characters around him, like, tell us, for example, about Wing, the Navajo.
Well,
Brandon, and
he's actually based, you know, that Indian's based on Swift Eagle, my Indian corporal in Vietnam, and it's based on, of course, the Navajo Code Talkers. I did a lot of research on those guys, and they were amazing. But it seems like, you know, when you talk to most Marines, it seems like in every Marine unit, there were some standard issue Marines, and it was always an Irish gunnery sergeant, and it was always some Indian of some sort in your unit. And so, you know, it's hard to write a story about a Marine Corps platoon without having those characters in it. And you know, those are the true stories that make the Marine Corps so colorful. They're, you know, and all those characters really are based on real guys.
And I know, you know, in these politically correct days, we have to say they were Native Americans. But in the book, if we talk about them as Indian, it's not derogatory. I mean, these guys were fantastic. The Navajo Code Talkers were amazing and so brave. They in so many cases, their work saved the lives of so many.
The Japanese could never break the Navajo Code. They never did figure it out. And, yeah, of course, there's a couple of books about it now, but... It was top secret stuff until after the war.
It was a clever idea, and these Native Americans really, they went right up to the front lines. I mean, we're talking sometimes past the front lines to get into the positions so that they could report the positions of gun emplacements and troop placements. And you cannot find a braver bunch of guys in the world.
I talked to another Marine he wasn't Navajo. I think he was Cherokee. Anyway, he a Marine, and I told him we couldn't find Swift Eagle after Nam, you know, and everybody was always wondering what happened to him, and he said, well, a lot of those guys went back to the reservation, you know, after they got out of the Marine Corps, and he said, when the rest of us were being treated so badly, and we were when we came home from Nam, it wasn't. I wasn't home 48 hours, and I was already being hauled off to jail for decking a war protester. He spit on my uniform, so we were treated pretty horribly. And but a lot of the Cherokees and Navajos, Apaches, whoever, they would go back to the reservation. And he told me that on the reservation, the first thing a lot of Marines, a lot of Americans did is take their uniform off when we came back from Nam, just to keep from having to get in fights. But not the Indians. They went back to the reservation, and they wore their uniforms proudly. And they actually wore them with their medals. And they were held in high esteem by the tribe and by the entire reservation. So I in some ways... You know, those reservations were a lot more patriotic than the rest of the country was.
Well, that's, you know, these stories are so important, I think, to keep forward, to let people know about what it was like. And you have written so realistically and so compellingly. And as you said, there was a Native American and there was an Irishman. And you write fantastic dialogue. You know, this is a real tell. Some authors can, you know, write descriptive narrative very, very well, which you do. But then dialogue is excellent. Your dialogue is fantastic. It's, when you read one of Johnny's books, the dialogue, it just moves it along. The story moves so nicely. I was right in amongst the story based on the fact that you write beautiful dialogue.
Oh, thanks. Thanks. It's a great compliment. It really is. I really appreciate it.
Well, you know, as a matter of fact, as we were talking about a movie, so much of it reads like a film script, which is a great compliment from the point of view of wanting a story to move, because it doesn't stop. It just whoop, 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 whoop. It goes, and I love it.
Thanks. Well, it's really fun to talk to somebody who's talking about one of my books other than Guns Up, because it usually, you know, if I do a radio show, a TV show, whatever, and they only want to talk about Guns Up, and they've only read Guns Up. They never read any of the others, you know. So it's really nice to hear something nice about one of the other books.
Well, I think Guns Up is, you know, more autobiographical. I mean, it's your story, and you're talking about, and you're the main character. But in this case, where you've really developed a unique character, which is always so important in a novel, and all of the people around him are so believable, it shows a real talent. And
thanks.
And people should get this book, because I didn't read Old Corp first. For some reason, I just like the title, No Better Way to Die, and I was intrigued by that. And so I was checking out what should I read, and then I read the prologue to that, and I thought, this is a smart prologue. It captures a feeling. And once I was hooked on the prologue, I couldn't put the book down.
You're making me wonder what the prologue was. I don't remember it.
Now, I was going to say, because what happens is, and this is so funny, I did the same thing to Clive Cussler, and I said to him, you know, I really like the prologue. And he's going, what, what? And I say, Clive, that's one of the best prologues I ever read. Because a lot of times people don't read prologues. It's funny. They go straight to the first chapter, forget the prologue. And so I'm telling Clive Cussler, that was a great prologue. And I said, you could be king of prologues. And he's like, what? What did I write? and then he realized, you know, and because, of course, I have this ability to remember books that I've read like 20 years ago or something. And of course, he's written like 54 books. And so he'd written 20 books in between that prologue that I was complimenting him on. And then he went, you know, on the radio show, he wasn't sure. You know, he was very happy that I was saying that's a great prologue. And then after the show finished and he went back and he read his own prologue, he came back to me and said, you know, now that I read it again, you know, I really worked hard on that prologue. I wanted it to capture this feeling of what I was, you know, going to tell in this story. And he was so amazed that I had noticed this prologue. But prologues, so you see, to all you writers out there, a prologue can be a very telling thing. And you might forget it after you write it, because sometimes you work so hard on the prologue. Oh, I see Big Ed in there shaking his hand. I can't believe it. This time has gone so fast. I've got only 4 minutes left. So I have to just quickly say that I'm so, so grateful that Johnny Clark is here today. I think I'll have to have you back after I read a few more of your books. I'm going to read Old Core next, and so maybe you'll come back.
Okay.
And then you can read your prologue, and we can talk about how you came out with such a brilliant prologue, because I just don't have time. And I know you've got some new books coming up, so we have a lot of things to talk about. So you're going to come back, okay?
Okay.
Okay, because this is just wonderful to talk to a real American hero, Johnny Clark. Your books are available Amazon, Barnes & Noble.
Yeah.
And do you have a website?
Yeah, I have a website, johnnyclark.com.
Johnnyclark.com, so they can... all of my listeners can go there and see more about you. I just want to thank you so much, Johnny, for being in today. I know you're a fine writer, and it's amazing how you did it, that you just went to a class and were determined, and that's a wonderful thing. So I'm just really grateful for you coming in today, a real American hero, a Marine, and it is so important that everybody should just think about what the Marines have done for us over so many years. It's amazing. And I still am always shocked when I hear that at one point They wanted to get rid of the Marines. There was a time. Can you believe it?
Harry Truman almost got rid of us.
Harry Truman wanted to get rid of the Marines. I mean, like, that is insane.
Yeah, they were down to, you know, just, I think, one division left, not even a full division.
And he wanted to get rid of. Well, thank goodness and thank God that we have the Marines and that you have, you know.
By the way, my comedy, Section 8, it's about that. Harry Truman trying to get rid of the Marine Corps.
Okay.
It's a comedy, but
it's a comedy. Yeah. Well, you know, fortunately he didn't do it, and fortunately we have the Marines here, and we can honor you. And I, as I said, I'm so grateful for you to come in. Thank you so much, a Marine hero. So thank you, Johnny, and I hope that everyone will go to your website,
JohnnyClark.com. J-O-H-N-N-I-E.
N-N-I-E. I wanted to get that in there so people can look for it.
Yeah, hi. Let's play Johnny's promo that you recorded. I think Johnny is such a wonderful guy, and I am so thrilled that he's going to be joining me again in March. And meanwhile, coming up next week, I will be announcing the list of 10 books that I'm recommending for the holiday season, and that you can go ahead and start buying books and sending them to people, because that's always a wonderful gift. You know, when you're not sure what there's so much nonsense stuff out there, but a book is really a gift of a lifetime, because when somebody receives a book from you, they probably will read it because they want to talk to you about it. And then also, they keep it. They tend to keep it. I have books. I have books that people gave me when I was, well, I don't know, 5 years old. And because I didn't get a lot of books when I was little, we were very poor. And mostly I learned to read from comic books, because we didn't have a lot of books. We had National Geographic magazines, which we preserved and kept, and I still have National Geographic magazines. I think maybe the first one that my father got when he signed up for a subscription was in 1953, and I still have that one. And again, a book is a gift of a lifetime, because it's not just something that they'll save, but it's something that they will treasure. And it goes into their mind. Whatever you do, when you read a book, that goes in your mind. And somewhere along the line, you are going to be thinking about it and thinking about the person who gave you the book. So if you have the promo for Johnny's book, Ed, do you have that ready? Okay.